Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Please help me in welcoming the wonderful Diana Wilder and her book, The Morning Tide. She also wrote a wonderful book called The Pharaoh's Son. Welcome, Diana.
Hi, Sherry.
Hi, it's great to have you.
Nice to be here.
Thank you. Tell us a bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I'm one of those people who had a terrible, terrible handicap, at least as far as being a writer goes. I had a nice childhood with good parents. We moved around a lot. My family always thought you should amuse yourself rather than expecting someone to do it for you. And my father used to tell us make-up stories that he made up just for us kids at bedtime. So I started making up stories myself. You know, people you might see for a couple of minutes, and I'd sit there and figure out what their lives were like, where they were going, what they were doing. And that's where I'm coming from.
That's wonderful. How long did you, like, write a little storybook and read it to your parents? Or how did you start writing stories? Or was it, like, in school? Or how did it start?
I started out writing poems. I had an idea about a poem. Somebody was talking about poetry. And I thought, I can write a poem. So I did, and it was terrible. But then... But then I went on a trip with my family, and we visited an old fort up in Montreal, and it was captured when the British took over Canada. And I had this idea of the people that lived there, and I started writing about them, and that's the first story I wrote.
That's wonderful. And does your reading ignite your imagination when you read a book, or do you get ideas from dreams? Where do your ideas come from?
Oh, they come from all over the place. If I read a book that really catches my imagination, it's like I'm in there. And I actually take things a step farther and imagine what the people would be doing quite outside what the book is. Some smart aleck said, yeah, and you always correct the grammar, too. But also, if I see something that suddenly strikes me, like one time I was going along and there was this big, tall fellow, he looked like a basketball player, and he was sitting in the waiting room of a hospital, and he had a tiny little baby on his lap. I mean, that child would fit in his hands because he was so tall and long, and the baby was so tiny. You know, what was that all about? Did his wife maybe have another baby? I think not. That was too young a baby, but why was he there? And he was smiling so happily. You know, something like that just sort of catches your imagination, and you make up stories about it.
That's wonderful. So when you were writing these the stories from your imagination and, you know, like about a baby, where do you start? Do you start with the idea, or do you start with characters, or do you start internally? How do you start with writing the book? Where does your creative process start?
Let's say with a man with a baby sitting there remembering what he looked like, and you can sit there and think, yeah, he was dressed casually. I mean, so, you know, like he was just come from a pickup basketball game, and then just suddenly figure where he would go from there. I think for me, I sort of follow people in my mind or stories in my mind along a path they might take, and what they might encounter as they follow the path, whatever it might be, from point A to point B, and you start thinking of details. Oh, he came this way here, and he probably stopped and spoke to somebody. It just, you know, it's funny when you try to explain it. It's very engrossing, and it's almost like having a conversation with the people in your head. Okay, why did you do this? Okay, what would happen if you went there?
That's true. I have that same thing when I write story or I'm working on one of my books, my characters tell me where to go. I don't tell them.
You can't argue with those people.
No, they're very strong-willed. When you go through your need to write time, I have to write, do you make deals with your family and friends, or do they know, okay, she's going to write during this time, don't bother her?
I never really had to do deals with them because it's like, oh, God, she's going to be writing. I guess we better leave her alone. If I'm off on another planet wrestling with a scene, there's always a danger that I'm going to come to Earth with a bump and see somebody looking at me repeating something that they said and rolling their eyes. But what often happens is they then say, okay, hand it over, I want to read it. Say, well, it's not ready yet. That's all right, I want to read it. They're really accommodating, but they also expect that I'm going to have something for them to look at, which I'm always happy to do because then they'll criticize.
That's true. But sometimes you're not ready at all. I mean, it's just like a sketch in your head and you're just starting to scribble and it's just like notes. You're not really ready for them to read it because they won't really understand where you're going. At least that's how I feel.
Oh, yeah.
Because just because you're writing doesn't mean you're immediately structuring a story. You're just doing something. You could be writing dialogue or characters. And for me, I do try to keep it in the structure, but sometimes I will come up with an idea and I'll write it on a separate piece of paper and then stick it in.
I had somebody pick up a sheet from a notebook I was carrying around, and it outlined a scene in whatever story it was I was working on at the time that was well established, but then sort of off somewhere was this totally often left field notation about, I forget what it was now, watermelons or basketballs or something like that. And they said, what on earth is this? I said, I don't remember.
Yeah, I always take those notes. I put it in the back of my notebook, and then maybe if I'm, like, stuck or I'm trying to figure something out, I'll take it out, and I'll look at them, and they'll say, nah, I'll put them back, and it'll work.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to use everything that pops in your head. You may use it later. But for another story, but you're not going to use everything that pops in your head when you're writing.
No.
Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. Do you have a love of history, and does that have any part when you're creating your stories?
Yeah, I always was interested in history. Basically, it all comes back down to history being a story. History is about people, and you can't get more interesting than a group of people and what they do.
Story of mankind.
So if you, I'm sorry?
I said the story of mankind.
Oh, absolutely. So if you, I never could understand how people could make history boring.
Yeah, me too.
But for example, one of the worst wars that Europe ever had started when an emperor sent a group of ambassadors to some people in a town like around Poland, to their castle. I think it might have been in war. No, it was Prague. Sent his ambassadors there with a demand that they knuckle under to him and be his servants and do all this good stuff. And the people of Prague listened to these ambassadors, who were also brave to bring such a message. And they picked the ambassadors up and they threw them out the window of the castle. And this is up on the top floor.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that sound awful? Well, yeah. What happened was, over the centuries, people have been throwing their trash and garbage and everything else out the window of the castle so that the moat of the castle didn't have water in it. It was just full of soft, squishy garbage and trash.
Yeah.
And these people landed in this pile of yuck and struggled out of there and went back to the emperor and said, these people did this, and the war started. But if you think about it, here's this horrible scene where these people have seized these ambassadors, thrown them out the window, and they're supposed to fall and break their necks, and they land in a pile of street
trash.
Sweepings, trash, and rotten vegetable matter. Can you imagine them struggling out of there and
yeah.
swearing and wiping off their clothing?
You can make a good comedy scene out of that part.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a famous thing. They call it the defenestration of Prague, you know, and
yes.
It's hysterical. You could write a story about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you could make it very serious and dramatic, or you can make it very funny. It depends on what you're doing. Because I see it both ways. I mean, I know it's real, but, I mean, just because history is real, some of the most interesting retellings of history sometimes is more interesting than the history, even though I know that it's not real. Like, if you see an old movie, and you're like, oh, that's really cool. Then you read the history. Oh, it didn't really happen that way. But I like the movie better.
I've done that.
Because you get really interested in it because you see the movie and then you read it and you're like, oh, it's not the same. That's the way I am. I always have to find out about the history of something. Like if I'm watching an old movie and I'm really fascinated by the time period, I'm the type of person that has to read everything about that time period because it's interesting to me. That's why I'm a writer, I guess.
Yeah, and then you take it and you run with it. Mm-hmm. And you think, wow, you know, why didn't they talk about this in the movie? Why didn't this happen in the movie? Then, of course, you have to write your own movie.
All right. Or have you ever, like, watched a TV show or a movie and it ended and you're like, wait, in your imagination you can see more. And in your head, you actually, you're not satisfied with the ending they give you, so you write your own ending.
Mm-hmm.
I've done that so many times. Actually, I've written fan fiction stories about. I watched the episode of one of my favorite shows. I don't like that. I'm going to end it different. And I wrote my whole. I think it was like a 10-page fan fiction story because I didn't like the way they ended the episode.
Oh yeah. I did that with a movie. It was an old classic movie with Bette Davis, and the actor's name was Paul Henri. He was in Casablanca, and it was about some woman and her journey from being a picked-on, downtrodden daughter.
Oh, Now Voyager.
To a really,
Now Voyager.
Yes.
Yes.
They ended that movie 20 minutes too late.
Yeah.
It had the perfect ending, and then they went on for another 20 minutes, and
yeah.
What is the matter with them?
Yeah, they cut there.
Wasn't that a fabulous movie? I loved
it. Yes, I love that movie. That's a very classic film. It's a great movie. Well, there's several of those that I just you can't get out. Like Laura, I can't get that out of my head. That just
oh, yeah.
I go, wait a minute, there's more. I mean, what happens to him? You know, it you can't help but do that when you're a writer.
Yeah, it's fun and drives you nuts at the same time.
Right? Exactly. That's exactly it. Give us a taste of what your book is. What do you want the readers to take away from the experience?
Well, I'll talk about Pharaoh's Son because that one is finished. Morning Tide, I'll talk about later if you like, you know, if we have time. But with that specific book, it started, it's one of those things like we talked about where you see a picture and you think, wait a minute, what if? And I was getting ready to take a trip to Egypt, which I never took because they had some terrorist activity, and I suddenly thought, maybe I'll go to Hawaii. but they had a photograph of this huge statue that was in the location that used to be the Egyptian capital of Memphis, and it had stood in front of a huge temple. Well, the statue's on the ground now, and everything was in ruins because the Nile had flooded, the levees had broken, and the Nile had flooded over the centuries. But I sat there, and I looked at this photograph of this statue, and I thought, holy cow, that thing was 45 feet tall, and when it came over, it must have made quite a thud, and I thought, gosh, that must have been something to see. And then I started thinking, that probably stood in front of a temple, because that's where they had those big ones. And I thought, and they often had festival days. What if it came down in the middle of a festival?
Ooh.
And that's what the story is about. It starts out with the statue coming down. And in your advertisement, you have the cover of that book. That statue on the cover is the one.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened then, what I wanted people to take away from it, I just wanted them to read it and enjoy it. It ended up being the question of, okay, did this fall on purpose? And it turns out it did. It was figured out early on. Why did it fall? What was the person doing, you know, or the people doing, trying to make it fall? And there are all these interwoven plots of someone trying to get at something that was hidden. And I'm not giving the plot away to say that when he knocked the statue over, he knocked the wrong thing over. He was going at it the wrong way.
Oh,
but
no.
Then going... Oh, my God, it was a comedy of errors, except that they were in deadly serious. But then going along with it were the characters that came in. The minute, as you know as a writer, the minute you get characters involved and you give them the reality that they deserve, and these are real-type individuals and not puppets that you're doing, when
mm-hmm.
you create them, you give them life in someone's mind to entertain them, to be real. when the characters stepped in, all of a sudden they had their own things going on. One of the main characters is the crown prince, the king in question. Pharaoh's son is a literal translation of the title prince. And there are a bunch of princes involved, and one of them is the crown prince, who's one of the two main characters. And when he came on board originally, he had not been a villain, but he had been a major pain in the neck.
Mm-hmm.
Obnoxious, arrogant. And in the course of the story, and as I was writing it, I began to realize why he was obnoxious and arrogant, and so did he, the character. And the story follows his journey from being resentful, arrogant, unhappy, desperately unhappy, to finding forgiveness for himself in his own mind, but the people that he had somehow unwillingly or unwittingly hurt in the course of the years prior to that. And he was one of the ones that was very much involved in solving the problem. The other one was his younger brother, who was a historical character. They all are, but this one we know an awful lot about. He was different. He was a very pensive type. He was the first historical archaeologist. What I wanted was to have people feel that at least for the time, they lived with these folks, they interacted with them, they watched them and enjoyed them, and actually felt as though they were in some way relating to them or friends with them. And I wanted them to feel like they were comfortable mm-hmm. in that time period, as though they had actually stepped into Memphis of 3,000 years ago, into a royal palace with all the different things going on, and just watched with enjoyment as the people did what they did and went crazy trying to figure out just what on earth is going on. And I wanted them to sit and laugh like fools when it turned out that the pharaoh was placed under arrest inadvertently by his son, the crown prince, and was not happy about it. You know, what I wanted was to have people read that, immerse themselves in it, let me entertain them, and then when the book was over, sit back and smile and say, oh, I enjoyed that. You know, this kept me interested. And that, you know, if somebody said that to me, it's exactly what I'd hoped for.
Well, that's the best satisfaction. Are you going to write a sequel? That's a great question, because it means you liked it.
You going to write a sequel? Well, yeah. Oh, what have you written? Well, about five pages.
Yeah, they're like, can you hurry up and write it? I'm like, do you have any idea what it means to write a book?
If you'd like to be a beta reader, I'll be happy to help.
Yes, here, start reading. Give me some editing. What is the biggest satisfaction in completing your book? And does it get harder as you write more books?
It was harder at the beginning because I hadn't known something that someone had told me. When I finish a book, I get the feeling that I've filled a hole in the story of the family involved or the line of the plots, and that's really good fitting a piece of the puzzle in. On top of that, you know, there's like feeling, oh, this is good. This is the best I can do. Oh, somebody's going to like it. You know, but it's hard to leave a group of characters behind.
Yeah.
You know, you become acquainted with them. You understand them. They've actually lived with you. You've it's almost like being a parent. You've mm-hmm. guided them and done what you think is best with them and tried to be true to them. And you miss them. And
yeah.
Does it get harder? Well, I can't say, because someone told me early on, don't ever just work on one story.
That's what I
always
do.
Have something in the wings. Yeah, so you do that too?
Yeah. I can't do it. It's not that I get bored with the story. My mind starts jumping, and I know I have to switch to a different story because...
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you have to take a breather, you know, and just step back, and that helps too. And then when you're through with one, you know, there's a certain period of mourning to a degree, but
oh, yeah.
You have something else that you can put your hands
on. You're already working on it. You're already immersed. It's weird because... I'm on the second draft of a memoir of myself, and it's such a different feel writing nonfiction. I've never done it before, nonfiction as opposed to fiction. Fiction, it's so directed by the characters and plot and stuff that you don't really think, okay, does this fit here and does this fit here, until you're finished and you're doing the editing stage. When you're writing nonfiction, it's like, oh, okay, what order should I put stuff in now? Because you're like, even though it's real, it's actually harder than for me than stuff that I'm making up in my head. It's an interesting dichotomy. I don't really understand it. Like I said, I've never experienced it before. I don't know other nonfiction writers, fiction writers who switch to do nonfiction have felt it, but it's just a weird thing.
I imagine it's in part because you're not only answering to yourself as the engineer of what's going on, but you're also answering to those who had a part in the events you're chronicling.
Yeah.
You can sit there and say, yeah, okay, yeah, that's right, but you don't remember that this happened. You know, and it's like you have another level that you have to answer to.
Yeah, and there's also, you have to be more, because there's no feelings in reality of the characters, so you're not hurting their feelings by saying, you know, you really are a jerk, I'm going to make you a bad guy. You don't have to worry about that when you're writing fiction, but when you're writing nonfiction, you go, I can't do that, I have to, you know, I don't want to get a libel suit.
Yeah.
What do you think about self-publishing? What do you think of the whole new media, Kindle, all that stuff? How do you feel about it?
Well, I think it's a good way to get your stories out there to be enjoyed. I think there are an awful lot more people now writing than there were, say, 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think it has benefits and drawbacks. And someone who chooses to self-publish absolutely has to take responsibility for putting out there the very best that he or she can do. I will say that one major drawback with self-publishing, and I have observed it with some of the products I've seen, is that it's altogether too easy to whip up a story, pretty it up a bit, and get it printed and for sale, printed or put into an ebook and for sale. The thing is that the temptation is very strong to get through the story that's dying to be told and then be able to sit back with a sign and say, there, it's done. But you can't do that. You have to make certain that your work is ready.
Yeah.
And that it really is the best you can do. Now, for me, I'm one of those people who has a terrible time waiting until the holidays, Christmas, you know, whatever, birthdays, to give a gift because I just know the person will love a gift and I want to enjoy the pleasure. And the thing is, it is better to wait. So I'll use an example of Morning Tide, which is the work I have in progress, and it's a little story about Morning Tide. It was all set to be released just before Christmas. I mean, the cover was designed, the editing, you know, the proofing and everything else. It was all set, and I was giving it one final read-through, and it's a story I really, really like, but I suddenly realized that if I cut out the first couple of chapters and started the action of the story in the third chapter and followed the story from there, it would be a whole lot more immediate. The blow of the loss, because it involves a death, the blow of the loss would be more keenly felt. It would be an altogether better story and one worth showing to people I want to please and entertain. And that was really hard to say, scrap the release date. Nope, we're putting this on, you know, we're pushing this back a couple of months. Because going along with that, then, as you know, when you start adjusting things, you think of ways that will make it even better. There are ways that I needed to heighten things. The story will be better. You know, it's hard. The story will be better. It would have been so very easy to say, well, yeah, but it's good right now, and I'm just going to go put it out there. Some people can't do that. And one thing traditional publishing does is they require a waiting period. I mean, it's not like, okay, we're going to publish you, but you have to wait. But in the time between a manuscript being accepted and the time the book is actually published, it is extensively edited, gone over with a fine-tooth comb, all these things. So, you know, at the time it comes out, it's pretty close to ready,
mm-hmm.
you know, as close to perfect as people can make it. Understanding, of course, that I've encountered some pretty poorly edited things no matter where I go. But, yeah, self-publishing with the people, there's a woman I know who wrote a wonderful story. She's close to 80 years old, and she suddenly realized, you know, after she'd been querying the manuscript to various agents, oh, for about 2 years, because it is a time-consuming process, she suddenly thought, I'm going to be 80 years old, and I don't know if I'm going to be around, and I want to see this out there. So she spent some more time making sure it was okay and getting the good cover and everything, and she self-published it. And now her family and friends, myself included, I'm a friend, having read her book, I am now her friend, had the chance to see it. And that's another choice that she made, was it was less time-consuming for her, and it suited her time frame.
Yeah. Also, because I've done both, you trust, I'm not an editor, and you trust an editor, and sometimes they mess you up really bad.
Mm-hmm. I've heard some horror stories.
And you read it, and you think it's okay, and you give it to the editor, and they do it, they do their job, and you get it back, and you look at it, and you're not an editor. And you look at it, and to your knowledge, it's good, and then all you do is get, because people can be really, you know, people who've never written could be really cruel.
Yes.
Like, well, okay, well, next time I'll do better. But which means I'll get a new editor. So I know what that is. I have been through that. It's just nothing you can do about it once it's already done.
Absolutely. Well, that's one other thing about self-publishing while I'm thinking of it, is if something is self-published, usually it is easy to fix a mistake. There was a lady who came out, I wish I could remember the name of her mystery. It was like a mystery and a fantasy, and it's traditionally published, and the typesetters accidentally left the entire first sentence of the very first paragraph of the book out. This publisher did would print the book in runs of like 2,000 or 3,000, and the corrections would not be public until that run had been sold out, at which point then they would pull the book out of production, fix it, and put it back in. And the author just made a joke out of it. She said, well, you know, okay, if you buy this book, I will hand correct the sentence and I'll autograph it for you. So she made lemonade out of lemons. But yeah. With self-published, you have print on demand, and you can find a horrible mistake and fix it very quickly.
Yes, but you pay for it every time, and that's hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you have to pay for it, reprinting or redone, and sometimes it costs as much as the book, so it's not quite that easy. Anyway, I really enjoyed talking to you. It was a wonderful interview. Thank you so much for coming on to Chatting with Sherry. I really appreciate it.
I very much enjoyed it. I'm so glad you invited me.
Thank you. Next week, we'll have the wonderful authors Gary Williams and Dean Nearly and their latest book, Indisputable Proof. Please join us next week. Thank you, Diana. It was a wonderful interview.
Thank you, Sherry.
Thank you for calling, and thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Good to be here.
I really, really appreciate it. It was a great, great interview, and I really enjoyed the conversation.
It was a lot of fun on this end, I'll tell you.
Thank you. Thank you for calling.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.